Well, it's that time of the day where we get to talk about anything else other than Nigeria, because I know we've had enough conversations about the country, and
yep,
mostly very negative, unfortunately, because everyone's feeling the bite of inflation and the rise in the cost of living, and I think everyone else is dealing with it in their own way.
Dealing with a lot of people.
But while you're trying to deal with it, because I'm going to introduce my guest to you in a bit, and we're going to leave the shores of Nigeria and talk about what's happening in Palestine, in Israel, and in Iran. Let's tell you how you can make a little bit of money for the weekend.
Yeah. So speaking about dealing with a lot, I'm about to give you a way out. Don't forget, Lagos, that there is money to be won every day here on Nigeria Info, okay? All you need is play with as little as 500 Naira. And in a few seconds, your ticket will be in the draw, my dear. All you need to do is go to www.oneplay.ng or just dial *347*880*3#, okay? Remember that the more you play, the better your chances of winning every single day, okay? You can win on the Money Crossfire. You can win money on WhatsApp Lagos, Sunnyside, Game On Shows, and Weekend People are not left out as well, because you can also win on the Football Frenzy Show. And every Friday, which is tomorrow and the weekend is closed, there'll be a jackpot of 500,000 Naira across the board. So please, yeah, you had it. My dear, no, you could have won a lot, but no. Okay, so all you can do now is tell a friend to tell a friend. And Lagos,
you could get half a million next week or this weekend.
Look at it. I mean, it could do a lot for people.
And all you need is 500 Naira.
500 Naira, Lagos. Stop playing those news, okay? Your chances are the same. Whether you play on the website, which is www.oneplay.ng, or you dial the code *347*880*3#. Remember to play responsibly, Lagos. I wish you luck.
Well, let's talk about the long history between Israel and Iran, because right now, what's most on the radar of Israel is Iran. And because of the conversation surrounding that, you know, the back and forth and the strikes, people have forgotten that aid needs to go into Israel, sorry, to Palestine. We've forgotten that the United Nations has picked up on something that they found around that hospital that was bombed, where they saw shallow graves, and they feel like people were bound, you know, with their hands, you know, and buried in shallow graves somewhere in Palestine. But then my guest is very versatile when it comes to geopolitics, when it comes to history, because he's a professor, one of my very favorite professors. Professor Scott Lucas is a professor at the Clinton Institute. He's also a professor emeritus at the University of Bellingham, and I love having him on the show. It's so good to have you, Professor Scott. So good to see you, and you look really good.
Thank you. It's great to be speaking to you from Ireland today.
I know. How's Ireland?
Well, it's great. We've just moved here permanently. Wow. So I've been in the UK for 40 years, and it was time for a new adventure. Wow. And so we live here south on south of Dublin. We can see the sea from where we are, and then the hills are right behind me. Wow. It's a pretty nice life. Wow. And I got to be honest with you, it's good to be out of Brexit as well and back into the European Union.
I know. But that's a conversation for another day. Brexit's off your radar now. But let's start by talking a little history between Iran and Israel, because everyone's wondering, why hit, you know, Iran and not expect that they will hit back? And then, of course, even when everyone was thinking that Iran was not going to hit back, they did, even though most of those missiles were repelled by the dome. And we hear that, you know, some of the Middle Eastern countries and the US were able to shoot down some of these missiles. No one was hit per se. But then Israel again went back to hit on Iran. And many are saying there's no love lost between Iran and Israel. Where did that start? Because I hear they used to be allies.
Yeah, they did. I mean, it's interesting that the two countries, kind of in their modern, because of course these are areas where the history goes back many hundreds of years, but it both starts after World War II. You know, the creation of the State of Israel, it has to be said, at the expense of the Palestinians, is in 1948. Iran had effectively been divided up during World War II between the Brits and the Soviets. And a combination of pressure between the U.S., the U.K., and other countries sort of pushed the Soviet Union out in 1946. And I'm sure your listeners will then know that there's this long history of relations, especially between, with the U.S., with the Shah, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got this developing relationship with the U.S. and with the Israel and with the U.S. and with Iran after that. But that, of course, means that Israel and Iran are kind of sort of linked up on the same side loosely. Mm. So there's a big economic trading relationship. Both sides are getting military support from the U.S. And that's all until 1979. And then you have the Islamic Revolution. And it has to be said that because part of that revolution is founded on the ideology that you cannot accept a Jewish state, that immediately is going to be a dividing issue between Israel and Iran. But there's an important twist in them. Just to give context, we got in the 1980s, Israel, probably on the idea of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, actually provided military assistance to Iran discreetly against Iraq because of Saddam Hussein. So there was still bargaining between the countries. And in the 1990s, it has to be said that under the presidents Rafsanjani and President Hatemi, you didn't really have that hostility towards Israel. It's really a 21st century phenomenon. Hmm. You have two things that happen. The Americans go in for the disastrous war in Iraq in 2003, which throws the region into turmoil. The Iranians, of course, have no longer have Saddam Hussein to worry about, but they have a nuclear program, which could lead to a nuclear weapon. That worries the Israelis. The Israelis, by 2007 especially, are ramping up pressure on the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. That creates more tension. And I think as an important backdrop for what we had in recent weeks, the one thing that really links the country in recent years that's provided a catalyst for escalation of tension is Syria. Mm. That horrible situation where the Assad regime killed hundreds of thousands of its civilians, Iran's an essential backer of the Assad regime to prevent it from falling. So its military go into Syria. Why should that concern Israel? Well, because Iran uses Syria as a route to send weapons and missiles to one of its allies, Hezbollah, who's in Lebanon. Mm. And of course, Israel and Hezbollah have been at war in past years. So what the Israelis do for more than a decade is they carry out missile strikes on the weapons and on the missiles. So that's nothing new that the Israelis hit Iranian targets. But last December, and I have to emphasize a few months before the incident we talk about, which is the embassy strikes, last December, they killed Iran's top commander in Syria with targeted assassination with a missile. They then killed the head and the deputy head of intelligence for Iran in Syria. They killed several other Revolutionary Guards officers. They, in other words, moved from targeting weapons and munitions to targeting personnel. And then on April 1st, I think the catalyst for what we're going to talk about is they not only killed Iran's overall commander for Syria and Lebanon because he was visiting from Tehran. Mm. They killed him and six other officers in the building where they were meeting. And that building, of course, was the consular building, which was next to the Iranian embassy. And that meant, of course, look, they'd gotten away with, Iran had not been able to respond to them killing their top generals. But for Iran to have them attack Iranian sovereign territory, because a consulate, an embassy is sovereign territory, of your country, that was just too much, which is why the Iranians would have to retaliate. But here I'm going to give the game away with a spoiler alert. Iran would retaliate with a demonstration attack, not an attack designed to cause widespread damage or to raise the stakes, but to thump their chest and demonstrate, oh, we can be tough, to which the Israelis would respond with a demonstration attack, not to cause widespread damage or cause direct war, but to say, oh, you think you're tough? We're tough as well.
It's really interesting. And many would really say that this is taking away from the fact that there's so much happening within Israel and Palestine, and it's taking away attention from it, and they think it's deliberate. But let's piggyback to what's happened of I think in the course of 3 days, where the United Nations is screaming about, you know, these shallow graves and people, you know, seemingly being bound. But unfortunately, Western media and every other media has not necessarily been able to gain access to Palestine to be able to report what they see on the ground, to be able to ascertain, you know, what some of these things that we're hearing. And so it makes it very difficult for you to analyze this from an unbiased standpoint. But tell me what you think about what's happened or that report by the United Nations, which is not the first of many.
Yeah, first of all, to lead into this, I don't think, by the way, that Israel designed this to take away from Gaza. I think that was a convenient benefit for them. As I've just explained, Israel wants to reduce Iran's ability to operate in Syria. And that's been going on for a long, long time. Mm. It's just, you might say, oh, the side benefit is, you know, it takes, it, and it did, it took everyone's attention away from Gaza for several days. Mm. Where we are with Gaza, to then answer your direct question, is just, we have to be honest and, to my mind, refocus attention on the fact that this is an open-ended war. There's no prospect of a ceasefire for reasons I can explain to you. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the day that he stops the war against in Gaza, unless Hamas has been, his terms, destroyed, his political and future is over, and he's probably on trial for bribery as soon as it ends. Mm. So there's a personal interest there. So, you know, what we're talking about here is not whether the open-ended war is going to stop and the killings of civilians are going to stop. We're talking about whether or not Israel's going to go into Rafah in southern Gaza, where you've got up to 1.5 million Gazans out of a country of 2.3 million. Imagine that, crammed into this city, trying to shelter from attacks, but the Israelis may be launching a ground assault. That intersects with what you're talking about, which is, you know, look, you know, there's a lot of back and forth propaganda. Hamas puts out propaganda, Israel puts out propaganda, but beyond propaganda, tens of thousands of civilians have been killed.
Yeah,
that we know. We know it from the UN, we know it from NGOs, we know it from journalists. The death toll, the official death toll, is over 34,000. Now, those bodies that are at hospitals, such as Al-Shifa Hospital, you know, I think it's quite right that the bodies are buried quite often in mass graves in situations of war, because you don't have time for dignified burials. Mm. You don't have resources. If you stay above ground to carry out funerals and so on, you could get bombed. Mm. So I think the question here probably is, you know, forensically, is, all right, who put those bodies into that mass grave? You know, they were, whoever put them there, whether it was Gazans burying their own or the Israelis just covering up what they've done, they were killed by Israelis. What has added, of course, and this is where I think we do have to be careful, is the lines that they had their hands bound, that, you know, some of them might have been sexually assaulted before they were killed. And I just have to emphasize to you, we have to be very careful about that. And I want to explain why. When the Israelis had hundreds of civilians killed, and they did have hundreds of civilians killed on October 7th, they, some their military and some other people put out stories that were not true, that there was mass sexual assault of those bodies. In other words, they sort of exaggerated what had happened there. Mm. And there is a possibility, of course, here that you want to make the Israelis look even worse than they do. So you say, you know, these people were like deliberately shot and deliberately buried. It's a huge war crime. Look, what Israel is doing is a war crime anyway. Mm. You don't need to exaggerate it. And that's my starting point when we talk about what we're finding out, the limited amount we can find out right now around Al-Shifa and other hospitals.
Mm. I like that, you know, you brought the politics into it. I love the politics part of it, where Bibi Netanyahu knows that there's a lot that he's going to have to face whether he likes it or not. And so the only option he's got, I guess, is to continue to prolong this war and make it look like, look, I'm doing you guys a favor. I'm trying to avenge the people who were killed on October 7th. But how long can he sustain that?
I think if Hamas said tomorrow, we're going to return the 130 hostages and bodies of hostages, because some of the hostages have died in captivity, to Israel, then Netanyahu can claim a victory, because he can claim that, you know, for all the Israelis who died on October 7th, look, we've recovered these people. And that's a very emotive, a very personal story for many Israelis. All you have to do is look at the protests that are taking place. You look at the families of the hostages who are calling for something to be done, and some families of the hostages are now joining the anti-war protest. So that would release the pressure on Netanyahu if it happens. But the kicker here is, of course, And even as Joe Biden, the U.S. president, and 17 other leaders today say, Hamas, you must release the hostages. Hamas are not going to release the hostages because they're leverage, unless Israel agrees to a ceasefire and probably a withdrawal of its troops from Gaza. You know, and that's the deal to be made. I mean, I'm just going to be blunt with you, is that you go back to the lines that were before October 7th. You get the hostages back. You get the bodies back. You allow Gaza to get international funds for reconstruction. But you can't do that if the Israeli military is continuing to control the area. So that's the deal to be made. It's the deal that Netanyahu doesn't want. Because the problem here is, even if the hostages return, Hamas will not be, his words, destroyed. There will be no absolute victory over Hamas. There will be that open question of who governs Gaza. And so I don't think it will mean that the rest of the war cabinet or the rest of the cabinet might necessarily fall. But the other piece in here is that many Israelis blame Netanyahu for October 7th because he led the country into turmoil. To avoid prosecution for bribery, he tried to put his thumb on the judiciary to make it bow down. That caused months of disruption in Israel. So Hamas had an opportunity to attack a divided country.
Interesting. I love how you put it. But let's talk about nations outside of Israel and Gaza. Let's talk about the United States, for example. And then, of course, Britain with your prime minister and the former prime minister. I think Cameron is, I think he's Secretary of State. What do they call them now in the UK?
He's Foreign Secretary.
Foreign Secretary.
He's Foreign Secretary.
Yes, perfect.
Yeah, I know.
In one breath, people are saying, look, you're engaging these guys, you're supporting, you know, the wanton killing of, you know, innocent people in Gaza. You're continuing to sell arms to these guys. It means that you're one way or the other supporting the war crimes that Israel's committing. And many were hoping that, you know, the prime minister would take a back foot on this and just, you know, maybe double down. But that's not been the case. We've seen the likes of David Cameron saying that they're not going to, you know, stop selling guns to Israel. The United States, on the one hand, Joe Biden is saying, well, don't go and attack Iran. We're not going to support you if, you know, you have an issue with Iran. But they're also saying ceasefire. On the other hand, they're saying we're still going to give you military. So everyone's wondering, what exactly is Joe Biden on about? And is he trying, on the one hand, to appease the people who he wants to vote for him in the next election and still trying to play home, or rather house, with Israel? I'm asking too many questions in one, but that's because I don't have too much time.
Well, let me start with the easy part for me, and that is that it's possible on the one hand for the Americans to say to the Israelis, look, we will defend you if Iran attacks you, which is what not only the U.S. did, but of course many other countries did. The U.K., France, and Jordan alone were active in downing Iranian missiles and drones. Saudi Arabia, the UAE gave intelligence, for example, to this attack. So you can say that because this is sort of linked to whether you don't want a wider regional war that takes place. And on the other hand, it's possible for the U.S. to say, as it did in a limited way, after the World Central Fifth, you need to stop aid workers and you need to allow the system to get into the area, which Israel did in the West. You know, you can sort of coexist with each other. My problem with the American Biden administration in Gaza is represented by the bill that passed yesterday, which included assistance to Israel. So it had, on the one hand, it had funds, billions of dollars of funds, at least $10 billion for more military aid to Israel. And at the same time, it had like at least $8 to $9 billion for humanitarian assistance to Gaza. So the same piece of legislation was providing the money to kill people in Gaza and then help them if they survived and weren't killed. You know, and that's where the Americans have got themselves into a corner, because the Biden administration will not use its ultimate levers. It will not call for an unconditional ceasefire, and it will not restrict military assistance to Israel. And until it does, the Israelis have this window to continue to operate in Gaza. Let me give you an interesting counterpoint, though, because I think a lot of people quite often hear this and think about the West. And I think it's really important to emphasize that this is not true of all of the West. Now, my former country, the UK, as you quite rightly noted, has maintained a similar line to the Americans. tut-tut, you should allow aid in. That's not good. Oh, by the way, British Aerospace would like to sell you more weapons. although Britain's military assistance to Israel is very small compared to the U.S. But I now live in Ireland. I mean, this is now my home. And I think it's important to note that Ireland is sort of leading the way in Europe alongside Spain and to an extent Belgium in criticizing the Israeli operations, in calling for a ceasefire, to the point where Ireland has now joined the South African lawsuit before the International Court of Justice over genocide. Mm. So I think it's important to realize that the international community is not all one stripe when it comes to, you know, approaching this conflict. Just as, since we're talking about Nigeria, not every African country has the exact same position when they look at Israel and Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nigeria's foreign policy is a non-alignment. So, I mean, we're just going to be like Switzerland in this case. We're just, you know, we're just going to sit and watch and just say, let there be peace. And that's it for Nigeria.
Well, I guess my message to Nigeria, if I would, to bring it back home here is that I can understand taking positions of non-alignment, and I want to be honest, for economic considerations. Mm. If you're Nigeria, you want to maintain really health relations because you might have trade and economic investment, which comes from the Arab. Mm. On the other hand, if you're Nigeria, you might have trade and investment, which comes from Israel. And you don't want to upset that. But I think you can maintain political non-alignment while having a very active humanitarian position. Mm. And that humanitarian position, as you've expressed it, really, you know, importantly, is that the citizens, the civilians in Gaza should come first.
Absolutely.
That should be the immediate priority.
Yeah. Well, Professor Scott Lucas here with us analyzing the situation in Gaza. Of course, the politics between Israel, Iran, America, the United Kingdom and several other countries. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, if you have questions for the professor, you better start writing them down. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. Welcome from the break. I've got just about 3 minutes before I let the good prof go. Professor Scott Lucas is joining us from Ireland. And we've been talking about the long history between Iran and Israel. I've got many questions, but I'm going to just take a few because of the time that we have. Someone here says, I want to ask the professor if the West has any red lines for Israel not to cross in the war in Gaza. If yes, have they? This is from Chooks.
That's a great question, Chooks. And I think we're going to find out very soon. And I think the question is if Israel proceeds with the
Oh my goodness, we're having a connection issue with you. We can barely hear you. Okay, you're back now. Yes,
just a bit.
Yeah.
No, that's a great question, Shooks. I think we're about to find out if Israel was to invade Rafah from the ground, given you have 1.5 million people there and many, many civilians would probably lose their lives. I think that would be the ultimate red line. If the U.S. did not act at that point by restricting military aid to Israel, I don't think the U.S. would ever act against Israel. Similarly, we would have to see how the European countries respond, and we would have to see what the UN could do. Remember that the U.S. did sort of modify its position by not casting its veto for the six-week Ramadan ceasefire. So it's possible that the U.S. might sit on its hands if there was another UN resolution that came forward.
Mm. Let me take another quick question, and then I'm going to let you go, Professor, because I know you've got other things to do. Someone's saying, with all respect, there's no Palestine. Don't you think Israel is fighting to regain their country from the Arab Palestine? And secondly, he says, you don't condemn Hamas for withholding hostages. Why why is Israel then trying to get rid of Hamas? Interesting question.
Very interesting. I mean, I do it again on this program. I've repeatedly said that what started this latest cycle of violence was Hamas's mass killings on October 7th. And I've said that it is not, in my opinion, proper for any analyst to present only one side of the story, that you have to recognize Hamas's mass killings and Israel's mass killings. But I have to say that the Israeli attacks, which have occurred since October 7th, are not just to get hostages back. They are actually to crush not just Hamas, it's to crush civilians in the country. It's almost to make Gaza uninhabitable. And the problem there is we can condemn Hamas for the mass killings. We can agree, as I say, that Hamas should be politically and economically isolated. But where are the civilians of Gaza going to get any hope if you keep attacking them? They will then run to Hamas and shelter as their only hope for support. And so that's what I would say. In terms of Palestine, there's always been a Palestine. There's been a Palestine for centuries. And what happened in 1948 is Palestine was erased during the Arab-Israeli war. Israel bears responsibility for that, and the Arab states bear responsibility for that as well. And the fact is that you have millions of Palestinians who are a people without a homeland, without a state. Mm. And anytime you have a people without a state, without respect, without dignity, that's an issue that we should all be concerned about.
Mm. Interesting. Well, I want to say thank you. Professor Scott Lucas has been talking to us about what's happening in Israel and Palestine. And I always love, to have him on the show. Every opportunity, I know he every time he sees a message from me, he's like, oh, yeah, here she comes again. I'm always asking questions about who can talk to me about this and who can talk to me about this. But I want to say thank you. We really appreciate you on Nigeria Info for coming. Professor Scott Lucas is a professor at the Clinton Institute. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Birmingham. And I hope that you enjoy that view. Hopefully I can come to Ireland soon, maybe on my next holiday, and come see that view with you.
Every time we chat, it brightens my day. So I look forward to doing it in person very soon.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day. Thank you for joining us on the show.